Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to the final episode of The Fern Line for 2018. It's been a pretty great year. It hasn't been without challenges, as I'm sure all of you can relate in some way or another. But the way I look at life and the way I look at the world and doing work and always moving forward in life is that I like to focus on the positive, and I like to focus on the things that you can wake up and do every day. And that's been a reinforced lesson in my life this last year. And I'm just so grateful that I get to do this podcast, that there is a growing community around it. And I just want to say thanks to all of you for continuing to be here. Wanted to share a few clips today before we get into our episode. And this first one comes from Colin, who does a lot of hanging out and exploring down in the California Sierra region.
To me, living a full value lifestyle means pushing yourself day in and day out in whatever it is that you're doing. Living a full value lifestyle means taking the inspiration, energy, healing, and power gained from being in the wild to better the world around you. Living a full value lifestyle is scampering across granite ridgelines in the fading magenta light. It's midnight alarms and 3 a.m. trailheads. It's taking deep breaths, opening your eyes and senses wide, and soaking in nature's glory, beauty, and wisdom, all while you enter a primal state of being. Simple movement. Living a full value lifestyle means not compromising on your dreams, desires, or passions for any of society's norms. A full value lifestyle is as simple as mountain air, a rising sun, and you. Thanks, Fernline.
And thank you, Colin. This next clip comes from Allie, who lives down on the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska, and she sent a clip in talking about some of the places she likes to listen to The Fernline.
I listen to The Fernline almost everywhere, but my favorite places to listen to The Fernline are on airplanes. I get bad flying anxiety, and it helps me actually focus and calm down, so that's pretty cool. Thanks for that. I also like to listen to The Fernline in my tent at night on fire assignments. Sometimes when I'm away from home and missing home, it reminds me of my place. So those are my two favorites.
All right, Allie, thank you. And this last clip comes from Brian, who is checking in from down in the Pacific Northwest.
So there's kind of two ways that I like listening to The Fernline. The first one right now this season has been driving to work, except it's not really your typical commute. I usually drive from Portland, Oregon to Bend, Oregon every other week, and I have to drive right by Mount Hood and just look at it almost the entire time, and it's sometimes really hard, but the podcast keeps me kind of motivated and thinking about other things and inspirational as well to let me kind of visualize myself up on the mountain when I'm just driving to work. And then for the first season, it really got me through some tough times last year, and I used to just listen to it while I was a researcher at Oregon State, and I would just cut wood panels for hours, and it was kind of really great to have some motivation going into it since I was also rehabbing a knee injury, so I couldn't do anything anyways. So those are my favorite ways, and I just love the podcast, and I'm just really inspired by all these amazing people, and I love hearing you tell their stories and kind of facilitate that.
I also wanted to give a shout out to the Fernline sponsors this last year. I have been so fortunate to be supported by some amazing businesses and entities in the community here in Alaska. I want to start out by thanking the Alaska Rock Gym. They've been supporting the Fernline from the beginning, and they have been offering an amazing arena and space for fitness, for health, for fun in our community since 1995. So absolutely stoked to be supported by and working with the Alaska Rock Gym. New sponsors this last year, the Moose's Tooth Pub and Pizzeria. If you've ever been to Anchorage, or if you live in Anchorage or Alaska, you've probably heard of the Moose's Tooth, or you've eaten their food or been to one of their events. Again, they're a great hub, a great community space here in Anchorage, and they do a lot of good work in the community. And I've been very fortunate to have their support this last year. I want to thank Dana Drummond and the staff over at the Hoarding Marmot. Hoarding Marmot came on as a sponsor in 2018. They're an awesome outdoor consignment shop here in Anchorage. They fill a really great niche in the community, in the outdoor community, and it's a really vibey, really welcoming, really fun atmosphere in their store. And fun fact, Dana, the owner of the store, is actually a really accomplished and totally badass mountaineer and alpinist himself, so much so that his mountain moniker is Mad Dog.
Mad Dog. Mad Dog. Mad Dog.
And finally, I want to give a shout out to Sam Johnson, owner of Behind the Sun Therapeutics. Sam is an exceptionally accomplished mountaineer and alpinist. I actually did a fern line with him last season. It's called Mindful Mountaineer, and I would highly recommend checking it out. Sam is a licensed clinical social worker here in the state of Alaska. He offers mental coaching for alpinists, for athletes, and he can do that work in person or remotely. So all of my sponsors have been amazing. Thank you all so much. And you guys can find the links to all my sponsors at the Fernline website, which is thefernline.com. Make sure you check them out. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch or camp chair and settle in for this episode of The Fernline.
I'm lucky to have this degree and this title, but, you know, I realize that in my community and where I come from, it doesn't mean a whole lot in sort of having this title. Like, it's about the character of the person you are and who, how you serve your community. And that's how I measure sort of my sort of impact and worth on a community.
On today's episode of The Fernline, I sit down for an engaging conversation with climber, educator, and activist Len Nessefer. I caught up with Len this last September when he came through Anchorage on his way up to the northern regions of Alaska, working on a film that's supported by the Wilderness Society in Patagonia. In the film, Len traces Alaska Native people's cultural connection to the land, how they live off the land, and why it's important. But we also talked about a lot more, including Len's experience growing up and identifying as Navajo, facing racism in college as he pursued a PhD, and of course, his love for climbing and the outdoors. It was a meaningful and honest conversation, and I hope you enjoy it.
And I always laughed. It's like, wow, like I, you know, that's yeah. And, you know, it was funny to hear that story. But, you know, one of the things I remember from my mom that was pretty great was, well, not like one of a motivating factor for her, and also hearing it from her was motivating for me, is that, you know, when she went off to college, my grandfather, basically told her, like, I don't know how to help you through this. You have to figure it out. And if you don't figure it out, you're going to have to come back and explain to everyone here why you failed. And, you know, talk about pressure.
Wow.
And, but yeah, I mean, I started, You know, and so, you know, coming from a family that was both teachers and educators, it was a sort of, there was a pressure that existed in doing that, but they were really sure to ensure that, like, I became a self-taught learner and, yeah, like, and really became sort of independent that way. But, you know, that started in Montessori school and just kind of like how that really forms, I think, a lot of the way and the way I approach things now. But yeah, as I got older, you know, there was a lot of feedback from my community and my mom and my dad that, you know, I needed to get an education in order to serve my community. And, you know, that gave a larger purpose to why I was doing that, because I have not been the best student. Mm-hmm. I trained as an engineer, but like I failed 2 math classes, yeah, you know,
and it's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. And I think one of the things that really, you know, got me going was that, you know, I kept thinking like, how am I gonna like use this to help my community, serve my community? And like, it was right there. My grandfather, my mom's dad was also a uranium miner. Yeah. And the history of energy development in the Navajo Nation is pretty fraught with a lot of exploitation and really bad history. And so my grandfather worked in a uranium mine. They didn't give him respiratory, you know, breathing equipment or breathing protection. And he developed silicosis when he was 40 in his lungs. And he had his whole left lung removed and he just battled with bronchitis every winter. Because the other thing was that where they lived in Shiprock, 30 miles down the road, there's a big coal power plant. And every winter, there's an inversion that forms in the valley. And so it would just like trap all of this coal, this air pollution in the valley, and he would get sick. And that's ended up what killed him. And so when I was looking at what do I do, where does my education go, I kept thinking about that. It's like, you know, this story of my grandfather is not unique to me. Like everyone in my community face this, you know, everyone has a uranium miner, coal miner, relative. And for the longest time, I thought like bronchitis is just what happened in the winter.
Yeah.
And that's like totally not true. And, so I went into engineering just because I was like, I have to figure out how this energy thing works. I have to figure out energy policy and like, we have to go down a different path because it's killing people. And so I went to school in undergrad for a mechanical engineering degree, and that was really tough. I went to school in University of Kansas, and you know, I was like 1 out of 2 Native students in the school, and it was just really like the amount of like racism and things that I faced going through school was just crazy. Like I look back on some of the things that I had to deal with, yeah, I was like, this is nuts. But it just made, you know, that whole experience really hard. And I like, there were so many times where I was like going to drop out.
Right.
And I didn't. I graduated somehow. But I graduated right during the recession. And I had to, you know, basically the choices I had were go to grad school or work in third shift in a railroad depot in West Texas. It's like, well, which suffering am I going to choose? Because like there was not really much I had to go back to. So I ended up going to grad school, and that was great. I mean, it was a much better environment, and I was able to do a lot more, but it felt more self-directed education. Like, I was able to sort of form my own educational path once I was in grad school, and I think that was a better fit. Right. Sort of learning what I wanted to in order to finish this larger goal, which was trying to figure out how do you develop a culturally appropriate and responsible energy policy for the Navajo Nation. So it was a, yeah, bit of social science, it was a bit of engineering. It was like, that was the larger goal. So that's what brought me to the PhD, and it was quick. It was 4.5 years.
Yeah.
But
how old are you?
30.
Yeah, you're young.
Yeah, I'm a young too. Yeah. But I went straight through, you know, and I think, you know, one of the things that I always remember is that, you know, I'm lucky to have this like degree and this title, but you know, I realize that like so much in my community and where I come from, it doesn't mean a whole lot in sort of having this title. Like, yeah, it's about the character of the person you are and, right, how you serve your community.
Right.
And that's how I measure sort of my sort of impact and worth on a community.
Yeah. Well, in talking to you for 15 minutes now, I mean, that that really comes through. It seems like it's really important for you. For whatever reason, you're driven by wanting to have a purpose, an intentional purpose for the things that you're putting your energy into.
Right.
Let's shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about climbing in the outdoors. So maybe just talk about how that first happened for you. How did that connection happen? And maybe just talk about that part of your life.
Yeah, it's kind of, I kept thinking, I've been having to explore this question in some stuff I've been writing. And I was attributing it to moving to Colorado and being in that environment. But I remember it as I did do climbing as a younger kid. And where I'm from in northeastern Arizona, there's a lot of Anasazi ruins, or not Anasazi, ancestral Puebloan ruins, which predate us as Navajos. So Navajos moved into the area around 1300 AD, and the Puebloans have been there for 6,000 years or something. But those ruins that exist there, there's some things called Moki steps, which are these carved steps into the side of the sandstone cliffs. And sometimes they lead places, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they just feel arbitrary in a way,
Yeah.
I mean, or sort of contrived. Sometimes climbing stuff feels a little contrived sometimes.
Yeah, depending on what you're climbing.
Yeah. And I remember as a kid scaling those things, and you get pretty far off the deck.
I bet.
And it was, I remember as a kid, that just kind of feeling of electricity, that adrenaline of, getting the Elvis legs before I knew that's what it was called. And I'd be doing this with my cousins, and we'd be killing time, we'd be up at sheep camp and we just had time to kill and we'd be exploring. Yeah. And it was just sort of this, we didn't climb to climb, but it was just sort of this way to get places that we wanted to get to. And
sounds like you were being a kid and exploring.
Totally. And I never connected that to climbing until I got older. And yeah, I started climbing in Pittsburgh at a really small gym. It reminds me of the old Alaska Rock gym that was here. It was a very, very familiar feel. But I think coming from the West and then living in Pennsylvania, it was just kind of, it felt, I didn't want to climb outside because I knew of all the things that were at home that I could climb. It just kind of felt not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of let go of it. And I also just didn't really, the gym scene there was kind of this dating sort of, posturing of, it was kind of a weird scene there. And I didn't really care for it. And so I ended up kind of giving up climbing for about a year and a half and 2 years. And I moved to Colorado when I got that job with the Department of Energy. And right near where I live, there's a bunch of crags, within 5 minutes of work. And so I started going with some of my coworkers, and I really loved that. I hadn't really seriously climbed outdoors for a while, and it was awesome. And I think I realized why I started doing that. And, I've been doing it for about 3-4 years, actual roped climbing, but, climbing mountains and mountaineering stuff is kind of where I've done most of my work.
Cool.
And that's, yeah.
When you look back in the climbing stuff that you've done so far, what's a trip or right. something you've done that's been special to you?
I think last season I skied my first 14er, which was Quandary Peak, and it was a really bad snow year, but I learned how to ski 2 years before, and I was like, I just kind of got really into it, and I just started skiing everything on the resort, and I'm like, okay, this is great, but I didn't come to ski to be in the resort. I went to ski to be in the mountains, and it felt like this sort of pinnacle, and I think that was really powerful for me personally. But the other is that I would say culturally, the thing that really resonated deeply with me is that back in June, I organized a group of 5 Navajo folks, and we went up one of our sacred peaks, which is called Blanca Peak. It's in South Central Colorado. It's a big 14er, 20 some miles round trip and 7,000 feet of elevation. It's a big, you can do it in a day, But we did it in a day and a half, and it was, mm-hmm. you know, it was a big time, but it was really awesome because of the folks that I know that are Navajo. There's only like, before that point, there was only two other Navajo people I knew that had been to the top of that peak. And it was cool because the five of us went up during a weekday and it was just us. And that was, you know, I think awesome because for, you know, most of us, we've just heard this name of this mountain in the ceremonies and referenced in different cultural practices that we do, because we have four sacred peaks and they're sort of the, I would say the backbone of our religious beliefs are those mountains. And, you know, for most Navajo folks, like they've never been to the top of most of them. Right. And that was an awesome time to bring five folks up together and huff and puff all the way up to the top. Right. But
talking specifically about like climbing or doing mountaineering or outdoors type things, like what are some things that you would like to do moving forward?
You know, the story of the first climb of Denali, you know, Walter Harper, Koyukon native man, you know, that's a powerful story. And it's one that doesn't get told much. And the one piece that I've seen, then in researching that history, you know, I don't know of any indigenous woman that's been to the top of Denali, much less this sort of roped team of indigenous people that do that. So that's, you know, flying in, we saw Denali on the way in. And I think that's always been sort of just looming there, you know, and I think part of it is approaching that in a culturally respectful way, because this isn't, you know, my ancestral homelands. And I think it's important to be respectful of those beliefs around that. But I think, you know, for what I've been taught from the early age of being with my grandfather and being intentional, it's like, we're climbing this mountain for a purpose. And, you know, for a lot of our communities, one of the things that is really missing is, this sort of sense of hope or like sense of strength and belonging. And I think mountains in a big way can provide that. And I think having people to look up to, and I realize that like that's kind of the role I'm serving for my community, because when I was growing up, I'd look at Nat Geo and I was like, wow, this is awesome. And, you know, I'd idolize Jimmy Chin and Conrad Anker, and I was like, wow, I wonder if I could be like them one day, maybe. But you know, I think for the young native kids that are, you know, in communities and sometimes hopeless, it's like maybe that could be a way into providing that.
So then you're thinking about potentially maybe wanting to do a trip on Denali. Are you talking about maybe approaching it from the north side like Walter Harper did?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a pretty committing. I know, it's like, I think it didn't take him 3 months or something.
Yeah. I've gone down that. I've got in a past life, I did guiding work up there when I was a lot younger.
And
one trip we went up the West Buttress and went down out to Wonder Lake, which is a long way.
Really?
It is a long way. I mean, it's just, it's a big trip, and it would be a lot tougher going up it. I'll tell you that. But, it really is an amazing story. I can't wait to see how that develops for you, because that sounds like a great opportunity for you potentially to do that.
I think so. I think the power of mountains is something that, you know, we pull on in our ceremonies and our traditions. And I think that's, you know, looking at what is the opportunities for Native people in the future, it's like that could be one conduit to tell that story in a powerful way. Denali's on the list. And then in Arizona, you know, moving down there, there's a lot of really interesting stuff that I've been, Mount Lemmon is phenomenal. And, just becoming a better rock climber there is going to pay dividends for years.
Right.
But the other peak that's down there is called Babu Kiveri.
Right.
And that's a sacred mountain to the Tohono O'odham people. In their community, there's a 5-4 route up that peak, and that's ancestrally what they would have the young men go up as like part of their initiation ritual, you know. And I think one of the things that I would like to do is sort of tell, like, also have that be a opportunity to tell story for the community, and, you know, be sort of a conduit and sort of talking about the importance of this mountain, but also pretty scared up there.
I know the peak, it's stunningly beautiful and powerful. And,
yeah.
Yeah, it sounds awesome.
Yeah.
I would love to read stories about that or see films about it or listen to stories about it. Cause I find stories like that just really fascinating. And
yeah,
I think maybe cause I'm from Alaska. I mean, I grew up here and, you know, part of Alaska is important to me too. So,
right. It's a big part of the identity or DNA here, you know?
Yeah. You had mentioned, you know, you had talked about kind of back home that you had talked about like a sense of hopelessness. And I guess I wanted to ask you maybe to talk about that a little bit more and talk about candidly, if you want, about maybe where you think that comes from and what that's about. And
yeah, I mean, today is like, it's kind of funny we're talking about this today. It's like National Suicide Awareness Day. And yeah, it's, you know, in a lot of Native communities, there's a pretty prevalent and really big problem with suicide, youth suicide. It's a major public health issue in our communities. And, you know, I've had multiple people I've known have taken their lives or tried to take their lives. And it comes from, you know, a really deep, I don't know. I mean, but it's like, I don't know what their motivations are, but it comes from a really hard place of hopelessness, it feels like, in our communities. And the roots of that are, you know, our communities haven't always been this way. I think that's one of the things I remember. It's because of things that have happened in our history that have led us down this path. And, you know, I can point to things like boarding schools, residential schools that like my mom and my aunts and my uncles went through, and how, you know, they were beaten if they spoke Navajo, or my aunt ran away and like ran away, I don't know how many miles when she was 6 years old, to like get away from there. And they caught her and took her back. And I've seen, you know, that whole process of why did that happen? You know, why did that exist? It was, you know, because there was a really marked attempt to try to assimilate us. And, you know, if you can imagine any people, it's like, no one wants to be forced into something that they don't want, you know?
Right.
And, but, you know, doing that to young kids has long lasting impacts.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about child abuse, that affects people for the rest of their lives. But in many Native communities, you have an entire generation of folks that have been abused sexually, physically, you know, in these schools. And that has just rippling impacts through our community. And now we're seeing that because that generation raised kids, and that trauma gets transferred from generation to generation to generation. And now we're seeing the fruits of that. And right. It's really, you know, it's hard because, you know, the social structure that existed that, you know, ensured that, you know, sort of the stability of our community has just been, many Native communities has been shattered very deliberately.
Yeah.
And now it's sort of, we're in this place of like my generation and younger are trying to figure out, what do we do?
Yeah.
And how do we instill hope, and how do we try to be the best people we can and try to, like, you know, try to put an end to this trauma?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, when I look back, it's like, you know, as a kid, as a young man, I was really angry. I was really mad. I was really just like, I think in some ways I could have gone down that road of being very self-destructive if I didn't have influences in my life that kept me in track. And having a community and people that cared for me. And I realized that that's like a privilege, because there's a lot of folks that didn't have the support mechanisms that I did to like learn how to process that stuff. So, you know, I think that's one of the things that, you know, coming into and working with Native communities, I always have to be very aware is like the trauma that's there. It's like, I come from that too. And it's, I think in a way it was like building a bridge to like, let's figure out how to make this better. So it's kind of the thing I've always thinking about.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell that you have feelings about it.
Yeah.
Just like chatting with you about it. It's, I can see that it's kind of right there on the surface for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's kind of hard for me to ask the questions and want to talk about it, but
I think it's something that, you know, I've learned to become more comfortable talking about,
right?
Because it was a shame that I carried for a long time, because I kind of thought that, like, before I understood the history and sort of the roots of this, I thought this is just how we are, which is not true. You know, yeah. I look at my grandparents and they were very very solid individuals, but they didn't go through boarding school. They didn't have to go through that experience. But then I look at my mom and my aunts are, you know, definitely exceptions to that. But I have extended family. It's like, you know, I look at alcohol abuse, meth, murder, suicide. I mean, just the whole, like, that is really heavy stuff. And yeah. Like, I'm very fortunate not to have had that happen in my immediate family, but it's there.
Yeah.
And I know it's just been, you know, I think in some of that work, it's just, and what's motivated me is that, like, if I'm not going to do it, if I'm not going to use this education, this platform in the outdoors for something to, like, benefit my community at the end of the day, it's like, what's the point?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So is your dad white?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. He's Romanian Scottish. He's second gen American.
Okay.
So I knew my grandparents from Romania and Scotland.
Interesting.
Yeah. It was really, really, I'm like rooted in that identity too. Fossil fuels and globalization is why I'm here.
it's interesting. Like, this is probably maybe like a difficult question to answer easily or quickly, but I mean, like maybe talk more about that experience of, you know, having your dad come from, you know, one, I guess, completely different culture than your mom's side of the family.
And, right. I've always been this bridge between those two identities, you know, because I would get questions from both sides of like, what's that family like?
Right.
You know, and I remember the, like trying to explain what a Navajo ceremony is to like a blue collar auto worker is like definitely a job, and vice versa. You know, it's like, yeah, I mean, one of the things is that it's definitely given, I feel it's, you know, I think one of the terms that always comes to mind, blanking on the word, but there's a Japanese term for like a mixed person, but it's kind of like a displaced person from both identities. But it feels like I can kind of step in and out of both and also be a translator in some ways, because you know, there's a lot of, you know, in the outdoor space, it's like a lot of people are coming into contact with indigenous people and indigenous history but might not know where to go with it, and then some native people feel really upset that people are recreating on their lands, and I feel like I kind of bridge that a little bit. But what I've been doing, you know, in sort of my own life with that is trying to, you know, become deeper rooted in those things and learning more about my Romanian history, my Scottish history, and, you know, of course my Navajo as well, but, you know, using that as, you know, just to say like, we're all, you know, we all come from our backgrounds, but I think it just feels really grounding to know, like, I know all these identities.
Yeah. Do you identify more with one side of your family than the other?
I think I definitely identify as Navajo first. You know, when we in Navajo, when we introduce ourselves, like our name, who our family, who our parents are, who our grandparents are, and then our four clans. And our four clans are like last names. So they basically show your lineage and where you come from. So if someone has the same clan as you, you're related, vice, you know. And it's always been that sort of process is like, you know, when I would introduce myself for the longest time, I would say just Bilagana, which is like just white people. But that's not, that never felt true.
Yeah.
To where I came from, because it's like, you can say white people, but it's like the identity I come from is like Romanian and Scottish, which I knew those great grandparents and they were vastly different foods, vastly different languages, vastly different cultures. I couldn't just like call them white.
It blows my mind thinking about it actually.
Yeah. And so it's like, all right, I'm going to introduce myself as like on those two clans, Romanian and Scottish. And that's what I've been doing. And I think that process has been like, you know, knowing that as well. But to like add more complication to the mix, I started looking into the Navajo side and what those clans were on my Navajo side, which is Tochitni and Nakai Dene. Tochitni is actually a Hopi clan, which is a completely different people. And then Nakai Dene is a Mexican clan. So it's like, I don't know, it's just a mix of all kinds of things.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, with like the history of white people coming over from Europe and colonizing North America, I feel like, you know, people don't want to think about it. I think some people just don't give a shit. I think some people feel guilty about it. what do you think a solution is for addressing that.
Yeah, I think the, you know, one of the pieces I always try to preface this with is like, we don't choose the lives that we were born into.
Right.
We don't choose the history that precedes us. We have no choice in that. And that's, you know, that's fine. But what we do have a choice in is how we respond to it. And when we learn about these things and what we do, like that's where people have a choice, and like how they want to respond to it is however they want to respond to it.
Yeah.
You know, I think in my, in sort of where I, my choice in that was I learned about that history and I became really angry, really mad.
Right.
And just pissed off. And, that doesn't do anything, but one, piss other people off. And then also it damages me like internally and like, and, you know, it just eats me from the inside out, which is not good either. And I think, you know, the other piece that I remember is that, you know, the history of each Native people is so different. Their experiences are so different. You know, coming up here to Alaska, you know, I didn't have to deal with the Russians. Where, you know, that's a whole different history and like what people had to face. And I think part of what I try to model is that when I go to a new place, I try to learn that history and be aware of it. And especially when I'm going outdoors, if I'm going up a peak or if I'm going to ski down a peak or whatever, I like try my best to learn as much as I can about the perspectives of the people that have stewarded these different areas for thousands of years, because mm-hmm. it's just a simple respect is that, you know, I, you know, in terms of when I go outside, I try to give something back. And, you know, either if that's like sort of ceremonially of giving corn pollen, which is something we do, but it's also like I'm giving effort to learn something about a people that have lived here and call this place home. And I think that's the respect that I give and try to model. And yeah. And I think the other piece is that it's fun going out with some of my friends because, you know, and then I start getting all these questions because I've read, you know, a right. book on it before going out.
Yeah.
I think that's been, I think it just kind of adds this depth to my outdoor experiences where it isn't just about climbing the mountain, but just like, just being another piece in that fabric of human history and like being able to say, well, we're skiing here, but this is also a place where the Dena'ina lived or whoever. Yeah. And there's some great stories that come out of it. You know, I think that's been the, I don't know, the fun. There's a great Wade Davis talk about the shit knife. I don't know if you've heard about that.
I haven't.
There's a, you know, in reading about the Inuit and Inupiaq and in Canada, a lot of the communities were in here in Alaska too, were forced into living in a single village. And there was an older Native man that was like refusing to go. He's like, I'm not going, you guys, you know, and his family took away all his tools. And, you know, it's the middle of winter, you know, and summer in Nunavut, you know, really far up there. And he slips out of the igloo in the middle of the night and shits in his hand and makes a, and starts making a knife and then sharpens the edge with his saliva.
Wow.
And then he butchers a dog and then makes a sled out of that dog's rib cage and then just like disappears into the night because he didn't want to have anything to do with living in this village.
That's intense.
Well, you know, you want to talk about like real outdoor adventures. That's yeah. That's a piece of history I'm not going to repeat.
Right. So maybe let's talk about like your connection with Alaska a little bit more.
Yeah.
What was your first experience like coming up here? How did you end up in Alaska for the first time? And
the first time I came to Alaska was in high school. There was there's a group called the American Indian Science and Engineering Society, and it's like an annual conference that they hold every year and brings together like Native scientists and engineers. And so I came up here in high school and, you know, we were stuck here in Anchorage, like in the middle of November, I think. And, I came with a bunch of other Native folks and, Navajo folks, actually, Navajo classmates. And that was kind of the first experience. And I remember just kind of being, I saw the Chugach, you know, and it was just like, whoa, those are some mountains, you know?
Right.
And interestingly enough, one of my classmates that came with me on that trip is a school teacher in Wainwright now. And she's Navajo and teaching there. It's really crazy. And so she, you know, she has her negative 70 stories and stuff like that. But I think that trip changed a lot of us in kind of understanding, like, you know, this history of the Athabascan, like, there are language relatives.
Yeah.
And we share a common language. I mean, I remember hearing Dena'ina for the first time, and it was like, those sounds are exactly the same as Navajo.
Wow.
You know, and it was just this click.
It's powerful.
Yeah. And I saw the mountains here, and, you know, I heard about, you know, the significance of, like, Denali and all of these things. And it was like, wow, that's, like, who I am too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I started coming up here a lot more in grad school and through my job with the Department of Energy. It came very frequently, I think probably once every couple months or once a month. You know, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and sometimes other places, but yeah, some of the villages. But it was really like my connection was working with the communities here, working with the native communities, the Alaska Native Corps, and yeah, people trying to make a difference for their communities, either on the health or energy side. And so, I think that was a really powerful sort of grounding force. But the other was just being so, you know, I told you like how I had grown up with a family that had, you know, we had agriculture and sheep, and that was like our sort of our subsistence or traditional hunting and harvesting, and how we were connected to the land. And coming here and working with communities that are so deeply connected to the land and traditions and food, and seeing that overlap, it felt very much like a lot of how that operated felt a lot like home, and it felt very familiar, and it was easy to sort of slot in. And I think that has always kept bringing me back. It's just that sense of community that's still there that I come from, as well. But it's also, that's the connection I really feel powerful. A powerful pull too. And the mountains are awesome too.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, in my time here, you know, when I was with the DOE, I would take short excursions up into the Chugach, a lot of stuff in the front, this range here, and climbing that stuff. And it's, you know,
yeah, I mean, you know, I've climbed all over the place, but the Western Chugach here is definitely, I mean, that's where I learned to be an alpinist for sure. As, and it's like the rock is really bad, but the thing that's amazing about the terrain and the peaks is the relief.
Right.
You know, big relief, lots of glaciers, gnarly approaches. It's just, it's like very, really adventurous and wild and beautiful and vast.
Yeah. I remember the first time, just, I don't even remember what peak it was, but we went up one of the drainages up here and just like popped over onto the saddle, and we got to see the rest of the range, like out east. And it's just, I don't know. It was amazing. You know,
it's a really beautiful place. So I guess just maybe like wrapping up talking about Alaska, what's a place here maybe besides the Chugach? And it could be where you're going to do the film, but like, where's a place or what's a village or an area where you feel really connected to?
I think one of the places where I really had a pretty deep experience was in Gulkana out by Glen Ellen.
Yeah.
There's a native village there. And, you know, the Wrangles are right there, and that's just, it's just endless mountains, but those were, I remember the highway that goes out there. We happened to hit it on it was a cloudy day. And then we pulled up over this ridge, kind of dropping down into Glen Ellen, and the clouds cleared.
Yeah.
We just saw the Wrangles, and it was just, you know, and that was awesome. But we were doing a community workshop in Gulkana, and we were sitting in this room, and I introduced myself in Navajo, and, you know, I could see some of these elders and from the community just like really perking up, like they knew I was Navajo, you know, because they actually had some Navajo family that lives in the village. I don't know why, but traditionally, like, some of our taboos is like we don't eat fish.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and like after the end of the first day, one of the older women was bringing around smoked salmon. I didn't get any. And I was like, what did I do? You know, I thought I had said something wrong, and like everyone was so nice. And then
you're like salivating.
Yeah, and I was like, what? And she's like, oh, I thought you're Navajo, so you don't eat fish. I'm like, no, of course I do. That was a powerful experience. And then the other was when I was working in, up in Yutkevik. I think that's how you say Barrow. We were at a tribal college there, and out at the old naval station, there's a tribal college now. I think it's Ilgisabik College. But one of the things that was really cool is that in the dorms there, they have these two refrigerators that are filled with traditional foods for the students. Like if they feel homesick,
yeah. You
know, they can go and eat. And one of the students like basically took us on a tasting tour of Northern Alaskan cuisine, which, you know, is pretty cool. I've never eaten fermented walrus before, but it was quite the experience. But yeah, I think the connection to communities through food has been the deepest.
Yeah.
I felt.
Man, you know, you're talking about geographically that the area by Glen Ellyn. I don't know if a lot of people would make this connection, but you know, to me, it's like a really powerful spot because you're like geographically, you're in between like four separate mountain ranges.
Right.
You know, the Wrangells, the Chugach, the Talkeetnas, and then the Alaska Range.
Right.
It's like right in between them. And I feel like I never hear like people talk about the significance of that, but is that like an Athabascan area?
Yeah. It's an Athabascan community. All through the interior is Athabascan.
Right.
And, you know, along the coast, you know, down south, Tlingits and then Yupik and Inupiaq, and but the Athabascans are interior, and that was like, you know, one of the stories in their stories. It was actually really interesting. One of the older woman that, you know, skipped me over for salmon ended up telling me a cool story. She's like, oh, you Navajos, like you guys left on a glacier. Like they said that we went off to go find buffalo and everyone came back. Or I don't know what it was something, some story like that, but they said that we had left on a glacier and like floated down. And, you know, that was really interesting to hear that story, that they had a story about us. But it was just cool to, you know, their sort of connection to the land is so deep, just as it was from mine. And, you know, I see, you know, especially in the outdoor sphere, like the more people spend time in these mountains, like people are really starting to have these really deep experiences with these mountain ranges and these places. And I think that sort of connection to place and is an entry point for having a conversation about the history, but also in a way that people are more receptive because it's a place that feels like home, you know?
Well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Len's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his wisdom, knowledge, and outdoor enthusiasm to your next trip in the mountains. I come alive with you. Most days we're doing all right. Once again, this is the final Fernline episode for 2018. I just want to thank you all again for listening and for being so enthusiastic about this show. If you're looking for ways to support the Fernline, remember that you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you want to take it a step further, if the Fernline adds value to your life, if you really enjoy the show, you might consider becoming a monthly backer on Patreon. You can sign up there at patreon.com/thefernline. Or just head on over to thefernline.com and click on the Support the Fernline tab. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear, well, you can check out more of my music on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fernline. Far away from the dreams and the lines that you crossed when you were younger. But oh, baby, I'm changing. Get down on the highway, I'm staying in the lines. I know you're out there waiting in the country, hoping that I realize I come alive with you. Most days we're doing alright. I come alive with you across